Hello, it's Friday, 28th of November 2008. I'm Mike Duran. On today's podcast, a tragic day in Mumbai.
The militants who are in both hotels have simply resorted to a fire and flee strategy.
We have eyewitness reports from the scene.
There was a huge explosion, so much so that the entire building sort of moved. And that was frightening. And I said, my God, this is a very heavy stuff.
Plus, we ask, why has Mumbai been attacked?
The importance of Mumbai is that it's the commercial, the financial capital of India. It's a symbol of India's tremendous progress.
In other news, the last two men convicted of the killing of a Hell's Angel are found guilty.
He was a fully patched Hell's Angel. He doesn't have criminal convictions. He seems to have been involved on the sort of biking side of things.
We hear some extraordinary 999 calls.
Go ahead, caller. What phone?
I'm thinking I'm having a baby right now.
You think you're having a baby?
Yeah.
First, a news update and a look at the papers with Sandy Waugh.
In Mumbai, India, commandos have stormed a Jewish centre where terrorists were holding hostages. Soldiers abseiled from helicopters to fight their way in as gunfire broke out. Meanwhile, soldiers are still combing two big hotels where gunmen have been holding more hostages and other residents have been hiding in locked rooms. Police say that in the Taj Mahal Hotel, an injured gunman is holding the security forces at bay. At the Oberoi Hotel, commandos have been releasing captured hotel guests, at least seven, possibly up to 30, including a baby, have been led from the hotel. Randeep Ramesh has been watching the operation in Mumbai.
The helicopter put down a dozen of them. They then quite carefully, cautiously, for these are obviously commandos, appear to be working their way down the floors of the building. Now, we had already known or had been told that the militants were holed up in one flat. It appears that they've spread out slightly.
But it is still the case that there are probably hostages held still in the Jewish centre in some way or other.
We still believe that there are hostages there because the sort of way that that's been run from the militant side, at least as we understand it, is that they have essentially pinned people down. The families are unable to move out because were they to do so, they would be picked off by sniper fire. So I think the security services idea, that's an army truck just running past a couple of columns, troops, is to flush them downwards, to push the militants down, so they have to reach the ground and therefore they have no vantage point with which to fire upon those Jewish families.
Randeep Ramesh in Mumbai. Meanwhile, it's now become clear that about 25 gunmen were involved in the attack that began yesterday. The Indian Navy's taken over a Pakistani merchant ship and is questioning the crew. There were reports the gunmen got into Mumbai in boats. The Indian newspaper, The Hindu, says three of the terrorists who've been arrested belong to a Pakistani group that's been involved in fighting for the independence of the Indian state of Kashmir. The Prime Minister of India said yesterday the group who carried out the attacks came from outside the country. In Thailand, negotiations have begun at the two airports serving the capital Bangkok between protesters and the police. Anti-government demonstrators have blockaded the airports for the last 2 days and closed them down. They've been calling for the government to resign and hand over to the army. The Prime Minister's declared a state of emergency and now it's expected security forces will clear the protesters and reopen the airports. Police negotiators have begun discussions with the protesters. The airport closures are causing Thailand serious economic problems at the beginning of the tourist season. Here in Britain, a Tory MP has been released after being held by police for 8 hours. Damian Green, the Shadow Home Office Minister, was arrested yesterday lunchtime after he published leaked documents sent him by a civil service whistleblower. His homes and offices in London and his constituency were searched. 10 days ago, the alleged whistleblower was arrested. Green was released shortly before midnight and said he was astonished by the experience and he'd done nothing wrong. His party leader, David Cameron, said the arrest had been Stalinesque. Football in the UEFA Cup. Tottenham beat Nijmegen 1-0. Manchester City beat Schalke 2-0. Both are well on their way to go through to the next stage. Portsmouth nearly caused a massive upset because they were leading the cup favourites AC Milan 2-0, but ended the game 2-2. All the papers lead with the attacks in India. Mumbai's day of horror, The Guardian calls it. The Times says the attack plunges India into new turmoil. The Sun puts a picture of a young gunman on its front page, calling him the boy from hell. The Independent chooses a picture of the British businessman killed by the gunman, Andreas Liveras, who managed to speak to reporters shortly before he lost his life. The hotel is shaking. Everybody here is living on their nerves, he told them. The Mail and The Guardian also put the arrest of MP Damien Green on their front pages. Terror police seize Tory MP, says The Mail. On the back pages, still more India, as most papers tell the story of the England cricket team forced to call off its one-day series. They're due to go back for a test series, but The Mail, like others, says the sportsmen don't want to. More on the day's news and breaking stories at guardian.co.uk.
First to India. They arrived in boats, branched out and headed for Mumbai's top tourist destinations. In a series of coordinated attacks, armed terrorists have struck several high-profile locations in India's financial capital. The targets, chosen for their symbolic nature, included the Taj Mahal Palace Hotel, the Oberoi Trident and Hilton Hotels, the landmark Chhatrapati Shivaji Rail Terminus, formerly the Victoria Terminus, a busy cafe opposite the police station, the Kama and Al Bless hospitals, a cinema and the Jewish Chabad Lubavitch Centre were also hit. More than 100 people have lost their lives. One British national is confirmed among the dead and more than 300 are injured. Eyewitness reports suggest the gunmen were specifically looking for UK and US nationals. Randeep Ramesh is the Guardian's South Asia correspondent and has the latest from Mumbai. He's been speaking to Guardian Daily's Tim Mabey.
I mean, it's a slow game of cat and mouse here between a small number of armed militants who are still holed up in three places. Now, what's been happening, as far as we can understand it, is the idea of hostages is really the people imprisoned by their own fear. When we talk to people coming out of the Taj, coming out of the Trident, really, they didn't know what was going on. They just barricaded themselves in the room, and there was no gunman over them. Instead, what we have is two or three people in each hotel who simply have run around shooting up various bits of the hotel and starting fires. And it's taken Indian commando this long to actually go and knock on each door and say, you can leave now. None of the security forces are willing now to say whether they can end it as rapidly as they thought last night. The other rather more dramatic pictures have come from the Jewish centre at Nariman House, where we've seen this morning, we saw Indian commandos take a helicopter and descend to the roof and then take, as we understand it, either the first two floors or three floors. Now, that implies that the militants are underneath and they're trying to force them out.
They came down onto the Jewish centre in quite a dramatic fashion, I gather.
And the helicopter put down a dozen of them. They then quite carefully, cautiously, for these are obviously commandos, appear to be working their way down the floors of the building. Now, we had already known or had been told that the militants were holed up in one flat. It appears that they've spread out slightly. We think one of them is either dead or injured.
What about the hotels?
Definitely, we saw a stream of people come out. They've just been released from the Trident Hotel. But this comes after, you know, what was a gun battle and a very large explosion in the Taj. So again, it may be that, you know, the security forces are encountering people, encountering these militants within the structure, chasing them off, and then opening the doors of those who have barricaded themselves inside both hotels. That seems to be the pattern of discovery.
The whole operation that the security forces have had to involve themselves in has been pretty dramatic, hasn't it?
Well, it has. I think it's moved to a different phase. What's happening here, the much more softly approach, with the exception, I would say, of the Jewish centre. Now, we know that the Israeli ambassador is setting up shop in Mumbai as we speak, and I think that they probably would have suggestions, if not guidance, for the Indian security services. These are Israeli citizens, after all, and it's a fairly explosive topic, the idea of capturing a Jewish proselytising theft. Security forces are well-versed with dealing with people. It's just that the kind of attacks they're having to deal with within mainstream India have really only ever taken place in Kashmir. That's where you see what they call fedayeen strikes, which are people who are prepared to kill and to be killed, taking on the security services and holding up in hard-to-reach places where they spread bullets and terror, while the security services can do little but to, lob bullets and grenades back. So I think that's what we're seeing, is the Kashmirization of terror.
Randeep Ramesh in Mumbai. India's Prime Minister Manmohan Singh says the attackers were intent on creating a sense of panic and vows to take whatever steps are necessary to prevent further aggression.
I strongly condemn these acts of senseless violence against innocent people, including guests from foreign countries. I offer my deepest condolences to the bereaved families and sympathies to those injured. The government will take all necessary measures to look after the well-being of the affected families, including their medical treatment.
During the crisis, 20 to 30 people are believed to have been taken hostage in the Trident Oberoi Hotel, with more than 100 trapped in their rooms. Witness to the attacks at the Taj Mahal Palace was Sir Ghulam Noon, a so-called British curry king. He escaped the armed gunman and has been speaking to The Guardian's Paul Lewis.
Yeah, actually, I have come with my three colleagues from England as well as from States and Malaysia. And we were looking for some joint venture in India. And we had a dinner in my suite at about 8 o'clock. At 9 o'clock, one of our colleague was supposed to leave for Singapore. So I went down with him to make sure that he gets his car organized. And as I was coming up, it was about 9:15. After exactly 5 minutes, I heard the gunfire. I first really thought that maybe it's the crackers, but then the gunfire became like a real gunfire in my mind. And then, of course, we realized that something is wrong. The initial rumor was on the television that there is a fight between the two gangs, but it became then, of course, it became intensive gunfire. And we were told by the hotel that please don't come out and jar your doors, you know, with with all the furniture you have. We could hear the gunfire, like exchange of fires. They were firing indiscriminately, obviously. Then, of course, we saw from our window, because mine was a corner suite, so I could see the activities downstairs. So the police were coming. Then, of course, the army came. The commandos came later on. And at one particular point of time, at about midnight or so, there was a huge explosion. So much so that the entire building sort of moved. And that was frightening. And I said, my God, this is a very heavy stuff. And then, of course, the small, like a grenade, and all these bombs the explosion was taking place, including gunfire. At one point of time, again, on the third floor, that was our floor, two terrorists were actually indiscriminately firing in the corridor, which we could see from the window hole, keyhole. And they covered their face, and we were worried that they might knock our door, and we could hear that they were kicking the door for some distance away, because it's a very large hotel. And it was a frightening moment. But the real fright came when of course, our television was off and our air conditioning was off. So we were only getting the news from our friends and families and my own children from London, because everybody was watching the television and were briefing us, oh, now there is a fire on the sixth floor. Now, when the fire became very intensive, then the smoke started coming down. And then we could see the smoke in entire corridor again through the people. We dare not open the door. We were warned again and again that please do not open the door. And we did not do that. Then, of course, the smoke started coming in. So we actually damped the towels and put the towels under the door. But still we could see that I could feel that my throat was hurting. So that means I was inhaling the smoke, and so was my friend. Then at about 6 o'clock in the morning, we waved out to fire brigade downstairs. They could see us, and we waved out because they could not hear us, because they were all windows and doors were shut. So they saw us, and they brought the crane. And with the crane, there was a cage, of course, and I pushed everyone out, and we came down, and I came last with another friend of mine, and that's how we were happy to be on the ground.
British curry entrepreneur Sir Ghulam Noon. Pakistan is warning India against accusing it of links to the Mumbai attacks, saying to do so would destroy all the goodwill between the two nuclear-armed rivals. Here, the Foreign Secretary David Miliband has issued this statement.
I think it's very important that I say that we are not going to speculate about numbers of people until we're absolutely sure that the facts are clear. We are not going to join any rumour mongering. We want to make sure that any facts that come out of the Foreign Office are absolutely correct. What I can tell you is that a special team combining Foreign Office officials but also Metropolitan Police officials has just landed in Mumbai and will be doing everything possible to help the victims and to help the Indian police with their inquiries. In addition, you'll know of the special phone number that's been established for people in the UK who are worried about their friends or relatives who are in Mumbai. About 1,200 calls have come through to that number, and I'm pleased that we've been able to match a number of people up with their friends and relatives. It's also important to emphasise that extra staff are being deployed into Mumbai from around India, and that's an important way in which we can help respond to what is an unprecedented attack on an Indian city.
A group calling itself the Deccan Mujahideen has claimed responsibility for this week's attacks, demanding the release of Islamic militants. Some commentators suggest they're following an Al-Qaeda blueprint, others that the tactics suggest a homegrown attack. The difference with these attacks is that bombs haven't been used, but rifles and grenades. The Guardian's Middle East editor Ian Black is here now to try and explain why this has happened.
What we appear to have here is some kind of hybrid, a combination of things that are local, homegrown, belonging to India and the region, and global. Obviously, international terrorism has been a big issue in recent years. There are elements of this incident, as I say, still continuing. Some of them seem to be very local and regional, and some of them appear to be borrowed from the wider movement. For example, we can look at different elements of it. Some of the style, elements of the style of the attacks, the singling out of Westerners, of Americans, of Brits, of Israelis, of Jews, appear to belong to this unhappy tradition of recent years of Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda type inspired attacks. On the other hand, it's taking place against an Indian background, a strong suspicion that the militants involved, whoever they are, whatever name they use, are linked in some way to Pakistan, perhaps, to Kashmir, to Bangladesh. So there's some kind of combination. But everybody who, even people who profess to be experts on this, they're all saying it's too early to say.
Well, you mentioned local and global. Are they in communication with each other, or are these just random events?
Intelligence officials have been saying that in recent days they've seen no evidence of what they like to call chatter, sort of warning of an impending attack. In fact, on the contrary, the focus has been in recent weeks on some kind of spectacular Al-Qaeda-type attack in some way timed in advance of or to disrupt Barack Obama's inauguration later in January, as if to say, you know, you may have a new president, but it's business as usual. So the attention has been focused on there, and this is part of something global, then a very significant blow has been struck in a completely different part of the forest.
Early reports suggested that Deccan Mujahideen claim responsibility, demanding the release of Islamic militants. What do we know about these? Are they responsible?
We don't know anything about them, and the name itself apparently has not been used before. Of course, it's quite common in the world of terrorism for people to dream up names on the spot. You can try and glean clues from that. I mean, Deccan is a region of India. Mujahideen is a generic Arabic word which means holy warriors. So it gives us some indication, at least, that they're certainly Islamists, I would have no doubt. Otherwise, they wouldn't be using that kind of label. There is a group that's well known called the Indian Mujahideen, which has carried out, I think, four attacks in the last year or so. So if they're related to them, they're part of something more familiar, certainly.
Do we know why Mumbai has had such a miserable history of terrorism?
Well, the importance of Mumbai is that it's the commercial, the financial capital of India. It's a symbol of India's tremendous progress. India is now the second largest country in the world after China. It's billed as the country of the future. China and India are challenging, we've heard recently in a very authoritative way, the dominance for decades, more than a century, of the United States. So Mumbai has tremendous symbolic value as a target, and clearly the eyes of the world are riveted on this continuing drama.
Ian Black, and you can keep up to date with the situation in Mumbai by going to guardian.co.uk/India. Elsewhere on the Guardian's website today, find out what happened when executives from the car industry met with Lord Mandelson. Go to guardian.co.uk/business. David Cameron is set to phase out public sector final salary pensions. Find out if he'll get away with it at guardian.co.uk/politics. Plus sport and homophobia, the meeting of rugby and gay rights group Stonewall. Join the scrum at guardian.co.uk/sport. Next, the last two men on trial for the murder of a Hell's Angel, dubbed Gentleman Jerry Tobin, have been found guilty. Tobin was shot in the head in August of last year as he was riding through Warwickshire on the M40. Seven men in total, all members of a rival gang called the Outlaws, will be sentenced today. Guardian senior correspondent Duncan Campbell has been following the trial.
Yes, he's an interesting character. The police say that he doesn't fit the normal pattern for somebody who might be chosen as a victim, and it seems he was just chosen completely at random because if he was a fully patched Hell's Angels, he had a very devoted girlfriend, Becky, who was in court throughout the trial, and he doesn't have criminal convictions. He seems to have been involved on the sort of biking side of things. He was a mechanic at a Harley-Davidson dealership in South London, and his main interest seems to have been in bikes, so it seems to have been just unhappily chosen as the victim by the Outlaws.
He was a Hell's Angel. You mentioned the perpetrators were Outlaws. Presumably there's been a long-standing rivalry between the two gangs.
There has. I mean, both of them, the Outlaws go back to the 30s and the Hell's Angels really to the 50s, although they came into their own in the 60s and 70s, and they, along with another gang or club, they prefer to be called a club, called the Bandidos, are the three major international motorcycle clubs, as they call themselves. There are various smaller groups, Satan slaves, outcasts, pagans, Mongols, whatever, but those are the big ones, and the rivalry between the Hells Angels and the Outlaws has been the greatest, and there have been shootings in Germany, in the United States, in the past.
These are all American gangs, aren't they? Is this another
They started in the United States, and they give out, they're almost like franchises. You have to get authenticated by headquarters in America as a legitimate chapter, and you have to prove that you're, first of all, you have to have a 750cc bike. The various different chapters have to prove that they can live up to the standards of the club. They're almost like golf clubs in some ways in the rules that they're required to observe. You have to go on probation, as it were, for 12 months. You're called a probate or a prospect. And once you've qualified, then you join the club, as it were. But once you've been authenticated as an affiliate chapter, then you're entitled to wear the patches, as they're called, and woe betide anyone who puts on patches if they're not allowed to.
And finally, I mean, do the police allow these gangs normal freedoms, or do they keep their eye on them?
They haven't been that active in this country. About 10 years ago, there were a couple of members of another club called the Outcasts who were killed in a battle outside Battersea Arts Centre, strangely enough, in South London. And nobody was convicted of their murder. And that was seen as a Hell's Angels attack on them. Apart from that, periodically there's suggestions that they're heavily involved in different forms of crime, but they've kept a fairly low profile in this country compared to what they have in the United States. And I think the police are waiting to see whether there are any reprisals. But the slogan for a lot of the clubs is God forgives and bikers don't.
Duncan Campbell. Still to come, the new taste of Little Chef as Heston Blumenthal spices up the breakfast buffet. Before that, most of us have heard examples of inappropriate calls to the emergency services. After dialing 999, operators have been asked, do you know of a good stain remover? Or the caller who complained about the lack of buses down his road. Now, previously unpublished 999 transcripts of genuine emergencies are being made available. We can hear some of those calls now. Firstly, a mum-to-be who gave birth while at home alone. Then the 5-year-old who reported his mother's epileptic fit.
Go ahead, caller. What's home?
I'm thinking I'm having a baby right now.
You think you're having a baby?
Yes.
Oh. okay. Hold the line, my mum will call me, okay?
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you some questions now. It won't delay the ambulance, okay?
Okay. Oh, wait. Jesus Christ. Oh.
Okay. How old are you?
30.
Is there anyone there with you?
No.
No one there with you at all?
No, they're on their way over, apparently.
Somebody's on their way over, are they? Okay. How many weeks or months pregnant are you?
40 plus.
You're 40 plus, are you? Okay. Yeah. And is the baby completely out?
No, I just got so much pressure and I'm pushing so much.
Okay. Can you see, feel or touch any part of the baby?
No, I don't think so, but...
Thank you. What's the problem? Tell me exactly what's happening.
My mummy's like... I don't want my mummy to go to hospital and I don't know what to do.
Okay, so what's actually happened to your mum?
Well, I can hear the makeup funny though. She was like shivering.
She's shivering?
Yeah, and she was asleep.
And she's unconscious. You can't wake her up?
No.
Have you tried to wake her up, have you?
Yes.
Okay, is it just...
I want my mummy!
Oh, I understand, okay. Right, help's on
the way. I'm going to have to name my daddy now.
Okay, help's on the way.
How many days is my mummy have to say that?
You can hear how both those calls were safely resolved, plus further 999 calls, tomorrow on the website at guardian.co.uk/weekend. Finally, if you pull up at a Little Chef in the near future for your fry-up, you might find a few surprises on the menu. Maybe snail porridge or sardines on toast ice cream. The award-winning chef Heston Blumenthal, owner of the Fat Duck in Bray, Berkshire, has been hired to turn round the fortunes and expectations of Britain's best-known roadside caff. The Guardian's Amy Fleming has had a preview of the new menu.
He hasn't really come up with any great surprises with bacon and sausages, apart from the sausages locally sourced, outdoor reared pork. It was surprising actually to hear him sort of boast that they contain 50% more meat than they had before, as if that was a very exciting thing. You know, his standards had, his expectations had dropped, you know, having to compromise dealing with sort of mass catering.
That 50% takes it up to what percentage?
I'm not sure, actually. I daren't ask.
Is it right that when he first arrived, there were no pots and pans in any of the Little Chefs?
Yeah, that's true. I think there was also pretty much just a microwave and a grill. And now he's got a charcoal grill. And the steak tastes absolutely fantastic because of that. And yes, I learnt about the pots and pans thing because in the loos there was audio playing of clanking pots and pans and sort of kitchen noises. And I just thought, what on earth is that about? And it turned out that, yes, there were no pots and pans there when he arrived. It was the first time he'd ever seen a kitchen without any. And I think he was so excited when the batch arrived that he then wanted to sort of celebrate this by clanking them around and playing them to customers.
And you've been down to taste some of these new dishes. Tell us what's in store for us.
Well, my favourite thing, I think, was the braised ox cheeks, which were which had been cooked for 3 days in red wine and just would melt in the mouth. Jay Rayner's favourite, the Observer food critic, his favourite was the macaroni cheese. There was a very exciting pudding that had, which was balls of exciting Haagen-Dazs flavoured ice cream, which you then skewered on and dipped in a chocolate fondue, hot chocolate sauce. That was fun. And a few of the puddings came with popping candy, which is one of his sort of, you know, signature fun sort of additions.
Did you get a chance to speak to some of the truckers or people who stop and eat at Little Chef who may be expecting this Olympic breakfast and end up with ox cheeks?
I did have a chat with a woman called Jess who's been working there for 9 years, and she was a bit worried that an elderly couple who were regulars there might be a bit disappointed by the lack of sauteed potatoes in the Olympic breakfast. But she preferred the changes herself.
The Guardian's Amy Fleming. That's it for today's Guardian Daily. The next will be available from 7:30 Monday morning. Producing today, Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey. I'm Mike Duran. Thanks for listening.